and mental conditions. Alpha energy, for lack of a better term, is to varying degrees part of a male human's biologically determined starting package. From there, through social feedback, it's either refined and developed by his upbringing, acculturation, and social affirming, or it's repressed, constrained, and mitigated by his social environment. When I was in art school, one of my most influential teachers told me, there are two types of artist. Those who were born with a natural, innate gift for art, and those who lack that gift, but possess such a passion for art that it drives them to be good at it. The true masters are the artists that combine both natural talent and the drive that comes from a passion for it. I've always referred back to this model in my creative efforts, but I believe this model can be extended beyond just the artistic sense. The Learned Alpha. Manosphere Godfather Roosh V has an excellent breakdown of the myth of the natural that perfectly encapsulates the learning theory of alpha. The premise behind this is that alpha behavior, and consequently facility with women, comes as a set of modeled behaviors based upon trial and error. Quote, if I were forced to agree on what a natural is, it would be a man who's a prodigy of sex. Someone who gets laid way above other men with no formal instruction in game. This means he was not exposed to any 12-DVD cocky humor sets or seminars in a hotel room with 36 other guys. You look at him and think, wow, he gets laid automatically. He was born to get laid. But he wasn't. Just because he didn't read a book doesn't mean he didn't learn through trial and error like you did, practicing his game on a large number of women. It doesn't mean he wasn't conscious and deliberate with his behavior, incrementally improving his moves and tactics over a long period of time. He has experimented like you have experimented, and he has also connected his attempts with results to figure out what works and what doesn't. He may not be obsessive about it enough to log his data into a spreadsheet, but he's mindful and aware of what he's doing. He understands the mechanism behind charm and can often turn it on or off depending on what he wants. He has learned the type of humor and storytelling that gets positive response in women. The last thing you can say about him was that he was born into the world with the automatic ability to fuck a lot of girls. End quote. Essentially, what Roosh explores here is a very basic behavioral psychology premise. Macro-psychological dynamics to micro-psychological schema are developed, deliberately or unconsciously, through a process of deductive trial and error management. Whether you're aware of it or not, everyone has game to varying degrees. Every man you know has some concept of behaviors and mental attitudes he believes will best help him arrive at sexual intimacy with a woman. Even the worst blue pill beta believes he has some idea of how best to get with a girl. All of this proto-game has been in a constant state of trial and error management since you were 5 years old and had your first interaction with the opposite sex on the kindergarten playground, right up to the point when you started reading in the manosphere and discovered the red pill. And you will continue to modify your old behavior and mental sets based upon the new information available to you after you adopt formalized game. In fact, in its rawest sense, the PUA community, the manosphere, and all its permutations are really a meta-effort in behavioral modification by way of experimentation and information feedback. For some, this learning process comes easier than it does for others. Again, Roosh, quote, the reason he blows you away isn't because of his genetics, but because of how early he started. A unique set of circumstances threw him into the sex game years before you, during a time he was lucky enough to be surrounded by giggly schoolgirls. By the time you did your first approach, he had already practiced his game on hundreds of women. End quote. While I do agree with this from a behavioral standpoint, this is where I have to depart from accepting Roosh's theory entirely. There are far too many biological and environmental determinants involved in developing an alpha male to ascribe an alpha status based solely on learned behavior. The simple, observable fact is that a genetically better looking, more physically arousing male is going to statistically have more opportunities to experiment and develop his alpha game prowess than a less physically impressive male. In theory, a man with a more advantageous physical presence will start earlier in his process of deductively evaluating behaviors, since his efforts will be more frequently encouraged by the women who are naturally attracted to his physique. Unfortunately, all of that assumes developing a behavioral set in a vacuum. There's literally a world of environmental conditions and variables that would predispose a man towards behavioral development of alpha status, or, more often, limit him from it. Roosh touches on this. Quote, at this point, you may be thinking, well, there have to be guys who were born with it. Look at Mozart. Nobody questions that Mozart's achievements were extraordinary compared with those of his contemporaries. What's often forgotten, however, is that his development was equally exceptional for his time. His musical tutelage was started before he was 4 years old, and his father, also a skilled composer, was a famous music teacher and had written one of the first books on violin instruction. Like other world-class performers, Mozart was not born an expert. He became one. End quote. I don't think this example excludes for a natural, innate talent, but it does help illustrate the environment's role in molding a person by limiting or encouraging his behavioral development and ultimately his personality. In the Mozart example, we see the success story. The story of a master artist, of a natural talent encouraged and developed to potential by favorable external conditions. Mozart was the perfect storm of natural talent and an ideal environment for nurturing it, thus giving him the advantage of an early start in his behavioral trial and error efforts. My reader Jeremiah laments, it is hard to believe there are still naturals out there when feminism is being rammed up the anus of every man before he sprouts his first tooth. And of course, this is a negative example of an environment deliberately averse to nurturing an alpha mindset. There's no shortage of examples, but feminization from a behavioral psychology perspective is nothing less than a socialized effort in deliberate behavioral modification of men's natural drives and predilections to better fit the feminine imperative. As men socialized in an all-encompassing, pervasive, femme-centric reality, we tend to see natural alphas as outliers because somehow, through some combination of innate gift and external development, these men have developed themselves into an alpha state, despite the meta-environment we find ourselves in. The Natural Alpha. A lot of people call my credibility into question when they read my holding Corey Worthington up as an example of an apex alpha. Guys who believe that alpha should necessarily mean virtuous leaders of men are understandably insulted by Corey's indifferent alpha swagger. The qualities of an alpha debates aren't going away, but I think there's an overall consensus among the manosphere and legitimate psychologists alike that there is an innate, probably testosterone-fueled, alpha drive that manifests itself in human males. No one has to teach the average, healthy, 5-year-old boy how to be alpha. He gets it on his own. That little alpha wants to explore his surroundings, take risk, see what works and see what doesn't, even when the consequences may be endangering himself or destroying the thing he took apart to see how it worked. It may manifest as a boy attempting to ride wheelies on his bike or a kid tinkering with his dad's computer. But that unrefined, irrationally confident alpha swagger is by order of degrees an innate element unique to the male condition. When a boy is unencumbered with an adult capacity for abstract thinking, ages 3 to 21 progressively, he is as alpha as he will ever be. He is unapologetically alpha, and it takes a lifetime and an entire world of feminized social conditioning to repress and or crush that alpha vigor and turn him into the pliable beta the feminine imperative needs to ensure its social primacy. This is precisely why the raw, irresponsible, irrepressible, obliviously unself-aware alpha energy of the alpha Buddha Corey Worthingtons of the world offend our sensibilities as well. All of the game theory, PUA techniques, even feminine serving appeals to man up, or any other effort designed to help men better mimic or internalize an alpha behavior or mindset. All of those efforts' latent purpose is to return a man back to the primal alpha energy the 5-year-old you had in spades. The contextual alpha. In March of 2012, James Hooker, a 41-year-old married father, left his wife and kids for his 18-year-old student. He resigned from his job at Enox High School in Modesto, California, over the scandal that shook up a community and put one mom on a crusade to save her daughter from a man she called a master manipulator. The girl, Jordan, met her teacher as a freshman. But both maintained nothing physical happened until she turned 18. Hooker claimed he saw Powers as just a student and had no romantic feelings toward her at first. But when her 18th birthday came around, things changed. They changed so much, in fact, that Hooker left his wife and 3 kids, one of them a 17-year-old Enox High School student as well, so that he could move in with Jordan. Well, as his Manosphere godfather Royce's, now Hartiste, want to do, The Chateau, Royce's blog, boldly nominated James Hooker as Alpha of the Month. As expected, the post comments got heated. But that's not the end of it. The SoSuave forum discussion thread, created by the sometimes overly passionate members in response, really gets down to the meat of the matter. How alpha will Mr. Hooker be seen by the general public? How alpha does the 18-year-old's friend think he is? If she has or had any at this point. What about new employment for the infamous Mr. Hooker? Will he take his soulmate to work functions he may be required to attend? There are probably loads of weird situations they will find themselves in. Or will they become a pair of social recluses? Think about it. That dude isn't alpha. He's more of the little rascal's alfalfa. Pathetic nerd. Before I launch into my take on this situation, I feel it's incumbent upon me to throw out this disclaimer. I do not condone Hooker's actions. At my time of writing this, I have a daughter who will turn 15 in April. And if there is any better indictment of the delusions of empowered single mothers and the inherent necessity of a strong, positive, masculine influence in a child's upbringing of either sex, I can't think of it. Kids need the resolute, protective fathers that far too many trademark, strong, independent women emphatically resist, run off, or covertly despise. only to further shame them for a lack of presence when an incident such as this occurs. That said, I agree with the Chateau's assessment. Hooker is an alpha, but only contextually so. From Royce's seminal 16 Commandments of Foon, emphasis mine. Number 12. Maximize your strengths. Minimize your weaknesses. In the betterment of ourselves as men, we attract women into our orbit. To accomplish this gravitational pull as painlessly and efficiently as possible, you must identify your natural talents and shortcomings and parcel your efforts accordingly. If you are a gifted jokester, don't waste time and energy trying to raise your status in philosophical debate. If you write well but dance poorly, don't kill yourself trying to expand your manly influence on the dance floor. Your goal should be to attract women effortlessly. So play to your strengths no matter what they are. There is a groupie for every male endeavor, except World of Warcraft. As a teacher, James Hooker is afforded a default status authority to students in a classroom. Being the teacher confers a contextual presumption of mastery, and thus a de facto social proof is conferred upon that person. In that theater, in that environment, the teacher is alpha. A uniformed police officer is perceived as alpha in his given role, despite his personally being a chump when off duty. As Royce illustrates, Hooker was playing to his strengths. In virtually any other social setting, he'd be perceived as a beta. The So Suave Forum and damn near every other casual observer pegged this guy for the beta simp he undoubtedly is. But in that classroom, to a 14-year-old girl who gradually matures into an 18-year-old woman, Hooker is alpha, and probably the only alpha she'd ever experienced. How alpha will Mr. Hooker be seen by the general public? In all likelihood, he'll be more publicly reviled than legitimate sexual predators when the genders are reversed. The great unwashed masses in the pop culture narrative don't recognize the legitimacy of alpha influence as it is. To them, it's psychological manipulation. And to a calculated extent, it really is. But the real question that nags them is why that manipulation is effective. They blame it on the naivete of the girl and her seeking a father figure, as well as the lasciviousness of Hooker. But what's really uncomfortable is why the alpha influence works. What about new employment for the infamous Mr. Hooker? Will he take his soulmate to work functions he may be required to attend? It's precisely because of Hooker's subscription to the soulmate myth that he reeks of beta. I have no doubt that he fluidly convinced himself of his noble intent narrative, casting himself as the savior for his adoring princess. White knights are prone to using their delusions of chivalry to rationalize good intent into the same behaviors they'd condemn in players, PUAs, or typical other guys in general. To venture a guess, I'd expect that Hooker buys his own bullshit. And because of this, he hasn't given an afterthought to how it will affect his career, his relationship with his family, his kids, or any future social circle. As an extension of this, along with his teaching job, Hooker has lost his contextual alpha cred. As his young chippy matures more, she'll begin to see that contextual alpha status erode with every progressive shit test he fails. Removed from the environment that made him alpha, fail he will. Alpha is as alpha does. In context, James Hooker parlayed enough alpha mojo to land a solitary 18-year-old girl, one he had to invest in for at least four consecutive years to consolidate on. In fact, I sincerely doubt he had any idea that he was situationally an alpha to the point that he thought he could intentionally manipulate this girl with it. There is a vast difference between the contextual alphaness of Hooker and the subconscious Zen mastery of it in Corey Worthington, the Alpha Buddha. Both of these guys are an affront to the sensibilities of the Alpha equals leader of men faction of Alpha definers, but both tap into a common root of Alpha energy that women naturally respond to. It's discomforting to think that the brave Marine fighting in Mogadishu, commanding the noble respect from his country and peers, taps into the same alpha energy that makes a guy like James Hooker attractive to women. Same alpha, different context. Hypergamy is a cruel mistress. Jerry Seinfeld dated and married his wife when she was 18, and while it caused a brief stir in the press, Jerry's wider alpha appeal pushed the story out of the headlines. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, both were banging and or marrying underage girls, but were given an alpha pass then and now. As I stated, I'm not condoning it. In fact, I find it deplorable, but I do understand why it occurs. Chapter 2,
Part 1,
Plate Theory.
Plate Theory 1.
Abundance and scarcity. Spin more plates. This is the main premise behind plate theory. Imagine for a moment a plate spinner. They're kind of like jugglers, but require a real finesse and dexterity to maintain a spinning plate atop a long, thin stick. Just like the plate spinner, a man needs to have a lot of simultaneous prospects spinning together. Think of each plate as a separate woman you are pursuing. Some fall off and break, others you may wish to stop spinning altogether. And some may not spin as fast as you'd like. But the essence of plate theory is that a man is as confident and valuable as his options. This is the essence of the abundance mindset. Confidence is derived from options. This principle is the key to solving so many of the problems that dog the heels of beta AFCs and recovering AFCs. In fact, I would say that this ideology should be the cornerstone to success for a man in many facets of life, not simply attracting and keeping women. A man with options has power. And from these options, and this sense of power, a natural sense of confidence will manifest itself. A man without options becomes necessitous, and this leads to a lack of confidence and a scarcity mentality. Necessitous men are never free. As we progress through this section, keep in mind the cardinal rule of relationships. The cardinal rule of relationships. In any relationship, the person with the most power is the one who needs the other the least. When a man spins more plates, when he has irons in the fire, when he is pursuing multiple women simultaneously, when he has options equally worth exploring, a man will have a natural, subconscious, but not exclusively understanding that if one prospect does not expand, others very well may. This understanding has manifestations in a man's behavior that women key on covertly. There are mannerisms and attitudes that a man with options will subconsciously convey to prospective women that they interpret and give this man a value as a commodity to be competed for with other females. On my blog and in the PUA community, men are taught to emulate this behavior
since it is a key element in attraction and interest.
Being cocky and funny is one such technique that trains a confidence behavior that, more often than not, essentially masks a deficit of options. CNF is a natural behavior for men with options that must be compensated for by those who don't have options. This is why the natural alpha male seems to exude CNF effortlessly, while those without the benefit of more plate spinning or the confidence in the ability of spinning more struggle with simple things like eye contact or initiating approaches. This is also a fundamental principle in the I don't give a fuck mentality that pervades community technique. It's much easier to actually not give a fuck if you have other prospects going simultaneously. Shotgun logic. One very important benefit that plate theory provides for a man is that it greatly curbs the propensity for one-itis both in and out of an LTR. Outside of an LTR, most guys subscribe to what I call the sniper mentality. This is the AFC that applies all of his time, effort, and resources patiently waiting out his target, waiting for that perfect opportunity to summon enough courage in the most precise of conditions to take his one shot at the girl, who by then is the focus of his one-itis. This process can take anywhere from a few weeks to a few years in extreme cases. But all the while, he voluntarily sacrifices his most valuable of resource, potential opportunity. The man who subscribes to plate theory can more easily avoid this situation as he goes hunting for women with a shotgun, scattering as much influence across the broadest area possible. While the AFC fishes with a single line and a single hook, the plate theorist fishes with a trolling net, selecting the fish worth keeping and tossing back those who aren't. Inside an LTR, plate theory becomes more specified. The AFC placates and identifies with his partner because the balance has shifted to her advantage since he reinforces her understanding that she is his only source of intimacy. I can't think of a better recipe for one-itis since he becomes progressively more dependent on her as his only source of intimacy. The man who maintains, at the very least, the covert perception of options, either professionally or on an intersexual level, i.e. social proof that other women will compete for him, maintains this power balance. Most successful men have an innate understanding of this, and this explains their popular reservations for committing to marriage. In an LTR, long-term relationship, plate theory becomes a subtle dance of perception and recognizing how your partner interprets understanding a particular man's options. But regardless, it reduces a guy's tendency to regress into one-itis in an LTR from his own self-perception and the confidence it inspires. Natural selection. Spinning more plates allows you more opportunity to select from the largest pool of prospective choices and date them or drop them as you see fit. This has two benefits. First, it serves as valuable, though non-committed, experience for learning what a man requires for his own personal satisfaction. Experience teaches harsh, but it teaches best. And the breadth of experience serves a man well. Whose insight is more beneficial? The man who sailed the world over, or the man who's never ventured beyond a lake? Secondly, opportunity and options make a man the prize. Rock stars, professional athletes, and movie stars aren't irresistible to women because of their celebrity, but because they blatantly and with the highest form of social proof, prove they have options that other women will jealously compete for as well as the confidence that this unconscious knowledge naturally manifests itself in them. What plate theory is not. Critics of plate theory will often take a binary stance in their arguments with this idea, stating that they could never be with more than one woman at a time out of respect for her. Or, so I should just lie to her and see other girls on the side? To which I'd argue that these are feminized social conventions that attempt to thwart a man's options in order to establish and or maintain women as the prime selectors in intersexual relations. If it can be conditioned into a boy or man to feel bad about seeing more than one woman at a time, or non-exclusivity in his relations with women, it only better serves the female as chooser dynamic. To be sure, women are naturally the filters for their own intimacies. But it is essentially men who do the sexual selection. The common trope that men do the sexual selecting is false. It's just that men's side of the sexual selection equation is a threat to feminine primacy in sexual selection. The latent purpose of social conventions that sublimate men's sexual choosing are designed to put selection of intimacy on a conditional basis that favors women. And as long as men will internalize this, women will have a pre-constructed social high ground. The way to circumvent this dynamic is brutal honesty and a commitment to truthful, non-exclusivity with the plates you are spinning. If you keep your options above board and are honest with any one girl and yourself about your choice to be non-exclusive, you not only remove the teeth from this convention, but you also reinforce yourself as a man with options, or at least perceived options. Further, critics will offer, "Well, gee, if I did that with any woman, she'd push off and dump me," to which I'll refute, "Not if you establish this honesty from the outset." Most guys who swallowed the female power convention are too afraid or too preconditioned to even consider this as an option for seeing women. Letting a woman know, or covertly perceive, that you won't be exclusive to her pushes your commodity level up and implies options and potential success she'll compete with other women to be associated with. That said, plate theory is also, most definitely not, a license to be indiscriminate with women. Just because you can spin a plate doesn't necessarily mean you should spin that plate. Some aren't worth spinning, and a man with options should have no reservation about letting one go for a better one or two. In fact, a man ought to be more discriminating in this regard, since it affords him the best available from the largest selection. Plate Theory 2. Non-exclusivity. Women would rather share a high-value man than be saddled with a faithful loser. The following is a quote from a rational male reader. "I just started applying plate theory. And I have to say with all honesty that this is probably the best thing I've ever done in my entire life. The feeling of having options is addictive. The whole idea that you don't come from a necessitous emotional state is genius. And in fact, the more options you have, the more attractive you become to women. Through the unconscious changes in your behavior, the more women become attracted to you, and the more options you have. Once you get it started, it's hard to stop it. Recently, I've been spinning plates with some success, but there comes a point when I risk one girl finding out about another. How do I handle this without the risk of losing one of my plates? Should I even bother with the effort of spinning plates that aren't as high of value as others? Real options are the cornerstone of confidence. So try not to think of it in terms of risk, as in you're risking the loss of a great girl. Most guys get to a point where game and plate spinning give them their first taste of real options to select from or fall back on when another doesn't pan out. The problem arises when they spin enough plates successfully
to the point where they think they've maxed out their best option. And the old beta mindset of scarcity mentality returns. Most times a guy who newly practices game and plate spinning never really spins plates per se. He uses it for the first monogamous opportunity that's been eluding him for so long and calls it quits. So he never actualizes and internalizes an abundance mentality. Spinning plates doesn't necessarily mean you're having sex with all of your plates. It's more of a spreading out of your efforts across a wider pool of subjects. Some will reciprocate, and those you entertain. Others will not, or prove to be less desirable, and those you let fall. This isn't as difficult as it sounds once you've established your own resolve to be non-exclusive. At some point, a woman will attempt to corner you into exclusivity, and this is where your resolve will be tested. Women love to say how they have rules. Well, you must have rules as well. This means not shacking up with a woman, not slipping into any routine with her, not calling her more than necessary to set up another sporadic date. Saving your weekends for women who've had a proven interest level in you, i.e. sex or physical intimacy, and relegating those who haven't to Tuesdays and Wednesdays. This may seem like a lot of micromanagement, but once you put it into practice, in as pragmatic a way possible to accommodate your life, you'll find that the decisions you make regarding the plates you are choosing to spin will become automatic. If you feel that you have something to lose with a particular girl, you're no longer spinning plates. You're thinking and approaching dating in terms of exclusivity. Long ago on the So Suave forum, the most enigmatic of members named Pook came up with a great quote. Women would rather share a high-value man than be saddled by a faithful loser. A lot of guys, and almost every woman, have a big problem with the truth of this because they take it too literally. Pook wasn't suggesting that you overtly declare that you'll be open to other options and that your girl should consciously be expected to accept this. Every woman takes this quote in this way, and with good reason, because they don't want to seem like an easy mark. When it's on the table like that, it unsurprisingly becomes an affront to their pride and self-worth. However, in practice, non-exclusivity has to be covert. It needs to be implied, not declared. Thus, you see the truth in Pook's observation. Women's behavior will bear him out. Imagination and competition anxiety, paired with implied non-exclusivity, are the cornerstones of successful plate spinning. Become the commodity she's looking for. A high-value man can spin plates. And sometimes those plates suspect there are, or know there are, other plates in his rotation. Women will tolerate this so long as he remains high enough value, or effectively presents that perception, to her from a sexual market value perspective. If not, hypergamy will move her along to another high-value man. As I state in Plate Theory 1, some plates fall off to be replaced by new plates. You must be willing and confident enough to let some of them fall. This is a tough reality for recovering chumps, new to game, to accept. Deprivation has conditioned them to hang on to a sure thing, and this becomes all the more difficult when the plate they happened to drop was the first woman they'd ever successfully applied game to, or was hotter than any girl they'd previously been with. As I mentioned earlier, you don't have to be sexual with every one of the plates you're spinning. This used to be called dating in the days before serial monogamy became the fashion. It's the potential in knowing that you could be, or that there are women on standby who will value your attention that prompts a competitive anxiety in women. If you are sexual with some of the plates you're spinning, so much the better, since you know that they're proven commodities, and if one isn't performing as you'd like, you have the unconscious knowledge that others will. or you have the proven ability to generate more options for yourself. Monogamy is a byproduct, not a goal. One of the biggest obstacles guys have with plate theory is breaking themselves of this LTR as goal mentality. Obviously, I'm not anti-monogamy. However, monogamy should never be a goal in and of itself. It should be a byproduct of plate theory, but only when you've properly filtered through enough plates to understand how options play into confidence and controlling the frame. The frame you enter into a committed monogamy with is imperative to the health of that relationship. If a woman is unwilling to be non-exclusive with you, i.e., she'll leave me if I see other girls, fear, she isn't a plate to spin. This seems counterintuitive to a guy with an LTR as goal mentality. And it is. But the guy who can fearlessly and honestly stay above board with his intent is the one who'll be spinning more plates and dating within his frame. Most guys, AFCs in particular, are deathly afraid of losing that one perfect girl, and so never even attempt to spin more than one plate, much less have any others to compare her perfection to in the first place. I've even seen PUAs do exactly this. They're so impressed with the success of newly perfected techniques that they settle for the one dream girl and find that their attentions become valueless to her because she perceives she is his only option for intimacy. His script gets flipped on him, and he gets marginalized. It's not a failure in technique, but rather a failure in his mindset. So what do you do to establish your plates and be truly and successfully non-exclusive with women? Initially, I suggest doing exactly what most women have perfected for the better part of their lifetimes. Internalize an intentional ambiguity with women. Women practice plate theory by default. They play the coquette, hard to get. They know how to be ambiguous enough to keep their options open, but not so much as to let a guy's interest fail. They naturally know that we only chase what runs away from us. They never commit fully, but still keep the carrot in front of the donkey. Women communicate covertly, with gesture, with looks, with veiled meanings. You have to communicate your intent to be non-exclusive covertly. Never overtly tell a woman you've got other plates than her spinning. Allow her to discover this by your mannerisms, your behaviors, and definitely by your availability to her. Create value through scarcity. Don't be so available to her, but just enough to keep her interest. And allow her mind to consider that maybe you have other options, even when you don't. Fomenting this anxiety is a very useful tool for you while you do get more plates to spin. Even the ambient confidence that comes from knowing you have a past, proven ability to generate more sexual options for yourself will manifest itself in your personality and trigger this competition anxiety. At some point, a woman will resort to overt communications when she's run out of options in her covert communications tool set. This is the point the anxiety becomes unbearable, and the need for security forces her to be overt. This is usually the stage at which she's asking something direct like, "Where is this going?" Or, "Am I your girlfriend?" Or she may even give you an ultimatum. See this for what it is. She feels powerless, and this is a press to commit. This is the point at which you'll end up as a cheater, or you'll continue to spin plates. You actually have a lot of options in this situation. In fact, more than you will ever have with any individual woman. You can, of course, take the coward's path and just agree to exclusivity with her. But in doing so, you lose all options. For as far as you're willing to commit, as she intently becomes your only means of intimacy. She becomes the broker for your options and sexuality, and you lose power. whereas before you were in control of your sexual availability. You could continue to spin her as well. But bear in mind, she's resorted to overtly confronting you about it, and it won't be the last you hear of it. Depending on how long you've had her around, you may simply just let her drop. You might also keep her going, but let her cool a bit and come back to her in a few weeks' time. Again, this seems counterintuitive, but your attention will either wildly increase in her value of it, or she'll simply bug out, in which case it wasn't worth pursuing, and you aren't wasting your time and effort on a woman with less than 100% interest level and desire. Confidence is derived from options. Don't think of plate theory as a filter so much as it is a means to reinforce confidence. If you were to step into the ring with a professional MMA fighter right now, it'd probably be suicide for you. However, train for a few years, spar with other fighters, and win a few bouts, and you'll probably be confident enough in your past performances that you know you can hold your own in the ring. That's the idea. Confidence derived from the options of non-exclusive women in hand, and from having successfully generated those options in the past. It's not a numbers game. It's a non-exclusivity game. The goal isn't racking up as many women as humanly possible in order to sift through the throng and find that one little golden flower. In fact, that's the key to disaster. There's no quality woman. That's an idealization. Some are better than others, of course. But you don't find the perfect woman. You make the perfect woman. There is no needle in the haystack. That is scarcity, one-itis thinking. The point is to mold yourself and any woman who you do exclusively end up with into your own frame. This is a process that should come before you commit to exclusivity, not after. The world is filled with guys forever trying to catch up. Control the frame and be the man they should have been long before they entered an LTR. They spend the better part of their LTRs, marriages, trying to prove that they deserve their girlfriends or wives' respect, when they'd have done better in letting her come to that conclusion well before the commitment, through a healthy dose of competition anxiety.
Chapter 2. Continued. Part 2. Plate Theory 3. Transitioning. You cannot help anyone until you've first helped yourself. The following was posted with permission from a consult I did.
Hi, Rolo. My name is Akash, and I'm a big fan of your post. They are always lucid, logical, and insightful. I discovered the community about 5 months ago after yet another failed relationship characterized by highly AFC behavior on my part. I ended it with a tremendous amount of guilt, as I felt that because she was a good person, I ought to have made it work even though I wasn't in love with her. I am 27 years old. Based on your post, I would really appreciate your advice on two issues. One, how to make the best use of my impending return to school in May for a second undergraduate degree, and two, how to overcome the cognitive dissonance I feel about pursuing women outside the confines of a committed relationship, as I still suffer from social conditioning that tells me I will hurt women by pursuing primarily sexual relationships with them, and so it is immoral to do so. If you would like to post a reply on the forum rather than by a PM for the benefit of others, that is fine with me. I wanted to direct these queries to you, though, as I believe I could benefit from your worldly wise opinion. Sincerely look forward to hearing from you. Best, Akash.
The following was my response. To begin with, you've only been involved in the community for the past 5 months. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is that it takes time to mold your personality and unlearn mental schemas you've become conditioned to and consider integral parts of your current personality.
one of the biggest obstacles most men have with accepting the fundamentals of a positive masculine mindset is the attitude that personality is static and uncontrollable by them. A lot of this, "that's just how I am" mentality comes from this basic conditioning and needs to be addressed from the outset, since this almost universally is an ego investment on the part of a guy who's probably emotionally distressed, confused, and or frustrated. Understand now that personality is ultimately what you determine it to be. This isn't to say that external factors don't influence personality. Indeed, these variables and outside influences are exactly the reason men such as yourself do seek out the community. However, it is you who determine what is comfortable for you and what will constitute the traits that make your personality your own. You are most definitely not a blank slate, but you have the capacity to erase parts you don't like or are unusable and rewrite new parts that you like and prove efficient. Issues. 1. How to make the best use of my impending return to school in May for a second undergraduate degree. This all depends on what your own personal goals are. The best use you can make of this time is to devote yourself completely to achieving the purpose for which you decided to pursue a second degree in the first place. I can only assume you are working for this degree with a set outcome in mind. But is this what you truly want? I ask this because I know far too many men who've altered the course of their lives to better accommodate the women in their lives or to facilitate their insecurities and fear of rejection. It's not an unfamiliar story to me to hear of how a guy opted for a certain university or a career path because he'd convinced himself that it would sustain a relationship that he was fearful of losing or he felt was his responsibility as a man to be supportive of her ambitions at the sacrifice of his own. The conclusion of this scenario, more often than not, ends with a bitter man, mad at himself with the long-term results of his choices, after the woman he'd striven so long to accommodate leaves him for another man who held fast to his own identity and ambition, which is exactly what made him attractive to her. I'm not sure how or if this fits into your conditions, but let it serve as an illustration for reclaiming and remolding your own personality. Only you have the hindsight to assess why you've made certain decisions in your life. I'm only asking you to be as brutally critical of your true motivations for making them. Maybe it's time for you to review why you decided to pursue a second degree. 2. How to overcome the cognitive dissonance I feel about pursuing women outside the confines of a committed relationship, as I still suffer from social conditioning that tells me I will hurt women by pursuing primarily sexual relationships with them, and so it is immoral to do so. Any reasonably attractive woman knows you'd like to have sex with her. It's a primal, chemical instinct. And to be bluntly honest, there's nothing wrong with it. In certain Islamic sects, men are allowed to take temporary wives for a set period of time in addition to their permanent wives, so long as they support them financially. Some Mormons practice open polygamy in a similar fashion. Some men marry and divorce multiple times and support them congruously, also known as soft polygamy. All of these practices are considered, to a greater or lesser degree, moral. The dissonance occurs when the rationalizations for a behavior conflict with the motivations for it and the associative psychosocial stigmas that get attached to it. Sorry for the $10 words here, but your feelings of guilt or hesitancy in a desire to explore multiple relationships is a calculated result of very effective social conditioning with a latent purpose meant to curb a natural impulse. Recognizing this is the first step to progressing beyond it and actually using it responsibly to your own advantage. As men, our biological impetus is a desire for unlimited access to unlimited sexuality with females bearing the best physical attributes. Ever wonder why pornography has been an ever-present element of human society for millennia? It simulates exactly this virtual access. This is a rudimentary fact, and on some level of consciousness, both men and women understand this. No amount of proselytizing or social conditioning will erase what God and evolution hard-coded into our collective biopsychological desires and behaviors. Admittedly, social conventions have historically made a good run at limiting this drive, but it can never, nor should it ever, purge this, because in essence it is a survival-ensuring attribute for us. I won't argue against the utility and the latent purpose of absolute monogamy. No other method proves more valuable in parental investment and developing a strong masculine and feminine psyche in a person than that of a committed, opposite-sex, two-parent family. I feel it's necessary to add here that I am thoroughly unconvinced that gender identity is exclusively a set of learned behaviors, as many in the mainstream would try to convince us of. There is simply too much biological evidence, and the resulting psychological, behavioral response to gender differences to accept this, making it vitally important that a child, and later a healthy adult, be taught a healthy appreciation for both the masculine and feminine influences in their psyches. The genders were meant to be complementary, not adversarial. I certainly would never condone infidelity based on just this principle alone, since it seems the most beneficial for healthy adults. It's when this healthy monogamy becomes clouded by infantile emotionality and insecure romanticisms, with the resulting expectations that are derived by them, that it becomes necessary for a man to cultivate an attitude of being the prize. Adopting this mindset broadens his selection of opportunities for monogamy to his greatest advantage prior to committing to monogamy. In other words, if you are essentially sacrificing your capacity to pursue your biological imperative, unlimited access to unlimited sexuality, pragmatically, you'll want to choose a partner of the highest quality from the broadest pool of potentials you are capable of attracting. The downside of this proposition is twofold. First, your ability to attract a sizable pool of quality applicants is limited by factors you immediately have available. At 37, if all goes well, you'll be more financially stable and mature than you are at 27. The 37-year-old you will, in theory, be more attractive to a long-term prospect than the 27-year-old you. Secondly, women's sexual value decreases as they age, meaning there is no guarantee that your beautiful, vivacious, 27-year-old bride will remain so at 37. In fact, the odds are she won't. All of this makes betting your biological imperative on monogamy critically important, thus deserving of the widest possible selection. Men literally live and die according to their options, so it stands to reason they ought to entertain a prolonged period in their lives where they are open to exploring the most options they have access to while concurrently developing and improving themselves prior to making a commitment of this magnitude. This is precisely where most men fail. They buy into and internalize psychological social contrivances, i.e., one-itis, that are little more than effective means of embedding a self-expectation of accountability and liability to make this commitment. irrespective of maturity level or personal success, not simply financial success. The saddest ones, the AFC ones, are the pitiable men who carry these contrivances into marriage and even old age without ever understanding that they had more potential which they